Climate Change the Facts. Global Warming, Models and Language. By Richard S. Lindzen. Richard S. Lindzen is an atmospheric physicist, former professor of meteorology at Massachusetts Institute of Technology from 1983 to 2013, distinguished senior fellow, Center for the Study of Science at the Cato Institute, lead author of Chapter 7, Physical Climate Processes and Feedbacks of the IPCC's Third Assessment Report, published 2001. As George Orwell said in Politics and the English Language, a man may take to drink because he feels himself to be a failure, and then fail all the more completely because he drinks. It is rather the same thing that is happening to the English language. It becomes ugly and inaccurate because our thoughts are foolish, but the slovenliness of our language makes it easier for us to have foolish thoughts. Global warming is about politics and power rather than science. In science, there is an attempt to clarify. In global warming, language is misused in order to confuse and mislead the public. The misuse of language extends to the use of climate models. Advocates of policies allegedly addressing global warming use models not to predict, but rather to justify the claim that catastrophe is possible. As they understand, proving something to be impossible is itself almost impossible. In a further abuse of language, the advocates attempt to rephrase issues in the form of yes-no questions. Does climate change? Is carbon dioxide, CO2, a greenhouse gas? Does adding greenhouse gas cause warming? Can man's activities cause increases in greenhouse gases? These yes-no questions are meaningless when it comes to global warming alarm, since affirmative answers are still completely consistent with there being no problem whatsoever. Crucial to the scientific method are how much questions. This is certainly the case for the above questions, where even most skeptics of alarm, including me, will answer yes. To a certain extent, therefore, this issue cannot be discussed between opponents. We are speaking different languages. That said, it should be recognized that the basis for a climate that is highly sensitive to added greenhouse gases is solely due to the behavior of the computer models. Within these models, the primary effect of increases in greenhouse gases is multiplied several-fold by the interaction of the increases with water vapor, clouds, and other aspects of the system that are openly acknowledged by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, to be highly uncertain. The relation of this sensitivity to catastrophe, moreover, does not even emerge from the models, but rather from the fervid imagination of climate activists. What are some questions that are relevant? 1. What is the sensitivity of global mean temperature to increases in greenhouse gases? 2. What connection, if any, is there between weather events and global mean temperature anomaly? 3. Is the notion of global mean radiative imbalance driving global mean temperature relevant to actual climate change? The meaning of this question will become evident later. This hardly exhausts the list of relevant questions, but in the present essay, I'll focus on the first item, though brief attention will be given to the remaining two questions. Climate sensitivity. The term climate sensitivity has come to refer to the equilibrated response of global mean temperature anomaly to a doubling of CO2. Because of the logarithmic dependence of the radiative impact of CO2, it doesn't matter what the starting value for the doubling is. Doubling from 1,000 to 2,000 parts per million by volume has the same effect as doubling from 280 to 560 parts per million volume. The very definition of climate sensitivity presupposes the answer to the third question is affirmative. While this may be true for more or less global forcing, such as that due to increasing a well-mixed gas like CO2, the paradigm is almost certainly inappropriate for major climate variations in the Earth's history. Estimates based on the temperature record. Using the surface temperature record to estimate sensitivity seems like an obvious approach, but in fact, it has substantial problems. Nevertheless, as we shall see, the record offers no support for high sensitivity and strongly suggests low sensitivity. Several researchers have attempted to use the record to plausibly establish likely bounds for sensitivity, and these point to a range of lower sensitivities than suggested by model results. However, none of this matters to those arguing for dangerous warming. As long as any possibility that sensitivity is high exists, they are content. There is an implicit, and sometimes explicit, appeal to the precautionary principle. Of course, the precautionary principle, for all its faults and fundamental incoherence, was not meant to suggest that one acts on the basis of possible but highly unlikely dangers. Rather, it suggested that likely, but not rigorously proven, dangers be acted upon. For the advocates of alarm, this merely means that they must insist, against the evidence, that the danger is self-evident, often based on the agreement of almost all scientists with the four trivial yes-no statements at the beginning of this essay. It is relatively simple to show how such considerations play out in practice using what are called energy balance models. In contrast to general circulation models, GCMs, where climate sensitivity is internally generated, these models assume a sensitivity and investigate the response of the surface temperature, where heat capacity is that of a relatively simple ocean model. When the chosen sensitivity is that of a GCM, the resulting evolution of temperature follows that of the GCM. As a result, these simple models are used extensively by the IPCC for scenario building. The specific model we will use is that described in Richard Lindzen and Konstantin Giannatsis' 1998 paper on the climatic implications of volcanic cooling. Before going into details, it is worth pointing out that these models describe an important feature of climate, namely, that high sensitivities are associated with long response times. Radiative forcing is a flux of energy, i.e., an energy flow per unit area, and sensitivity is a ratio of temperature change to this flux. High sensitivity means that a small flux eventually produces a large temperature change, but because the flux is small, the change will take a long time. Our exercise begins with two sources of forcing common to almost all models. The first is the radiative forcing due to anthropogenic greenhouse gases, CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, etc. According to the IPCC, this has grown from about zero in 1850 to about 3 watts per square meter now. This has resulted from the exponential growth of CO2. Note that we are already at about 80% of what one expects from a doubling of CO2 alone. The other is the forcing due to major volcanoes. Figure 1 shows a volcanic forcing estimated by Makiko Sato. The values are comparable to greenhouse forcing, but the volcanoes occur in two clusters with an intervening quiescent period. Such clustering is actually characteristic of random processes. Figure 2a shows the response of the model for various values of climate sensitivity. The observed warming has been about 0.75 degrees Celsius. This is exceeded by almost any sensitivity in excess of 1 degree Celsius. However, the calculated responses for models with high sensitivity are smaller than the equilibrium responses because of the long response times associated with high sensitivity. Figure 3 shows the response of the same models to the volcanic forcing. Here, the response time plays a particularly striking role. For low sensitivity, the response consists in episodic dips corresponding to each eruption, much as observed, while for high sensitivities, there is a secular trend leading to a net cooling of about 0.3 degrees Celsius at present. The absence of any evidence of this in the data already points to low sensitivity. However, for the present exercise, this means that the warming due to high sensitivity is moderated to an important extent by the accompanying secular cooling due to volcanoes. Figure 4 shows the response to the sum of greenhouse and volcanic forcing. It is still the case that only sensitivities under about 1 degree Celsius are consistent with the observations. However, the IPCC suggests that aerosols constitute a highly uncertain potential source of cooling. Modelers have been able to invoke this uncertainty in order to adjust the net anthropogenic forcing, i.e., the sum of greenhouse forcing and aerosol forcing, to match the observations in Figure 5. For the sensitivities in excess of 1.5 degrees Celsius, this is about half of the 3 watts per square meter, and already in excess of what the IPCC considers the likely aerosol contribution. But recent work suggests that even this estimate for aerosols is much too great. Of course, so far we have assumed that the observed temperature change is entirely due to the combination of greenhouse, aerosol, and volcanic forcing. We have ignored the potential forcing due to solar variability. But perhaps more importantly, we have ignored what is called natural internal variability. The fact of the matter is that global mean temperature anomaly would vary even without external forcing. Heat is constantly redistributed by the oceans on timescales ranging from years to millennia, leaving surface temperatures out of equilibrium with radiative forcing. Examples of this natural, non-greenhouse-related internal variability are the El Niño Southern Oscillation, ENSO, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. The instrumental record is too short to indicate longer period phenomena, though such longer periods are evident in proxy records of temperature. The so-called hiatus in global warming over the past 17 years is incontrovertible evidence of the importance of this variability. And as a 2013 study by Jun Sing Zhu and Kat Kint Tung has shown, such internal variability is likely to have accounted for about half of the warming since the late 1970s. Under the circumstances, getting models to replicate the much-reduced directly forced warming will require even more implausible cancellation by aerosols. It should be noted that the IPCC claims for attribution depend on assuming natural internal variability to be small. This is clearly not the case. However, what is generally ignored is that even if the attribution claim were correct, it would still be completely consistent with low sensitivity. After all, the above analysis assumed that more than 100% of the observed warming was due to man, allowing for cancellation of some of the warming by volcanoes. The IPCC only insisted on 51% being due to man. It seems to me that the most reasonable conclusion to reach under the circumstances is that climate sensitivity is small. Moreover, mild warming is likely to be a net benefit. However, I would not be surprised to see advocates of alarm soon arguing that it was the previously ignored natural internal variability that had actually disguised the large warming that would otherwise have occurred, thus leaving the possibility of dangerous warming in place. Other approaches to climate sensitivity. It has already been mentioned that high sensitivity is related to long response times, and that leads to a pronounced difference in the response to sequences of volcanoes. Figure 6 is the famous figure of the record of global mean temperature anomaly. Volcanoes appear as isolated dips consistent with low sensitivity, shown in Figure 3. Relatedly, the broad minimum in temperatures between 1883 and 1950, seen in Figure 5, is absent in the observed series. Models, however, have openly used hypothetical pictures of aerosols and solar influence to eliminate this discrepancy. Given the numerous possibilities for bringing observations and models into agreement, one might reasonably try to find more direct measurements of sensitivity. The response time that we have discussed is simply a measure of the thermal coupling of the atmosphere to the ocean. High sensitivity is associated with weak coupling, and low sensitivity with strong coupling. Thus, as Gerard Rowe noted, it should apply more generally to climate variations other than those simply due to greenhouse forcing. These include the aforementioned El Niño Southern Oscillation, Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, all of which depend critically on this coupling, and all of which are poorly represented in current models. Seeing whether reducing sensitivity would improve this situation seems like an obvious test, but to the best of my knowledge, this has not been attempted. One is left with the suspicion that the modeling community prefers to defend high sensitivity even when it means failure to simulate known phenomena. Neer J. Chavy used correlations between the solar cycle and ocean temperature to estimate the flux needed to produce the change in ocean temperature. This allowed him to estimate the amplification of solar flux, potentially related to cosmic rays, and their secondary effects on clouds and albedo, as well as climate sensitivity. Once again, sensitivity was around 1 degree Celsius. The climate forcing associated with added greenhouse gases manifests itself as radiative forcing at the top of the atmosphere. This forcing also acts on the surface, but no longer in the form of simple radiative forcing. Rather, the primary forcing is associated with what is called latent heat flux. This is simply the flux of energy associated with the heat evaporation of water vapor that is evaporated from the surface. Here, it has been noted by Frank Wentz et al. That whereas in models evaporation changes about 1 to 3% per degree of warming, it is observed to change 5.7% per degree of warming. The former is consistent with model sensitivities of about 1.5 to 4.5 degrees Celsius, but the latter is consistent with much lower sensitivity on the order of 0.8 degrees Celsius. In the absence of what are referred to as feedbacks, the expected response to a doubling of CO2 is about 1 degree Celsius. In current general circulation models, this warming is accompanied by feedbacks to water vapor and clouds, and, to a much smaller extent, to the reflectivity, known as albedo, of snow, which serve, in the models but not necessarily in nature, to amplify the response to CO2 alone. Feedbacks that amplify the response are known as positive feedbacks, while those that diminish the response are known as negative feedbacks. As we have already noted, high sensitivity is associated with long response times. It is common to consider water vapor and cloud feedback separately, but this actually makes little sense. Water vapor is important for infrared radiation, while clouds are important for both infrared and visible radiation. We will refer to the former as long-wave radiation and the latter as short-wave radiation. The water vapor feedback is an infrared feedback, but it applies only in regions free of upper-level cirrus. The aerial coverage of the upper-level cirrus, one type of higher-level cloud, is highly variable. We must therefore consider the total long-wave feedback. Similarly, we can look at the total short-wave feedback. Direct measurement of feedbacks with satellite data. An obvious approach to measuring feedbacks would be to see how outgoing radiation responds to surface temperature fluctuations. The crucial point about the feedbacks is that they respond to surface temperature fluctuations regardless of the origin of the fluctuations. Not surprisingly, this approach also has difficulties. Satellite measurements of outgoing radiation, both long-wave and reflected short-wave, are used in this approach. It turns out that the Model Intercomparison Program has the models used by the IPCC, forced by actual sea surface temperature, calculate outgoing radiation. So one can use the same approach with models while being sure that the models are subject to the same surface temperature fluctuations that apply to the observations. In principle, this should be a straightforward task. However, as already noted, there are difficulties. The first two difficulties involve basic physical considerations. First, not all timescales are appropriate for such studies. Greenhouse warming continues until equilibrium is reestablished. At equilibrium, there is no longer any radiative imbalance. If one considers time intervals that are long compared to equilibration times, then one will observe changes in temperature without changes in radiative forcing. The inclusion of such long time scales thus biases results inappropriately toward high sensitivity. Equilibration time depends on climate sensitivity. For sensitivity on the order of 0.5 degrees Celsius for doubling of CO2, it is on the order of years. And for higher sensitivities, it is on the order of decades. In order to avoid biasing sensitivity estimates, one should restrict oneself to time intervals less than a year. This problem is particularly acute for approaches which simply regress outgoing radiation on temperature without concern for timescales. The 2006 paper by Piers Forster and Jonathan Gregory, and the 2010 paper by Andrew Dessler. Moreover, given that the response time is shorter for low sensitivity, one has the ironic result that the bias toward high sensitivity is greater when the actual sensitivity is lower. There is also the need to consider time intervals long enough for the relevant feedback processes to operate. For water vapor and cloud feedbacks, these timescales are typically on the order of days. For practical time resolution, this is generally not a problem. Timescales on the order of 1 to 3 months are thus appropriate for sensitivity studies. Longer timescales also involve pollution from seasonal effects, etc. Restricting consideration to such short-term scales is the approach taken in papers by Lindzen and Choi, Spencer and Braswell, and Trenberth and Fazzullo. The second problem is more difficult. Outgoing radiation varies, especially in the visible, for reasons other than changing surface temperature, volcanoes, non-feedback cloud fluctuations. Such changes are not responses to surface temperature fluctuations, but they do cause surface temperature fluctuations. As the 2014 paper by Yang Seng Choi et al. Shows, the high noise-to-signal ratio makes determination of the shortwave feedback unreliable. However, the situation is better for the long-wave feedback, and the results of papers by Lindzen and Choi, Spencer and Braswell, and Trenberth and Fazzullo all point to either the absence of long-wave feedback or negative long-wave feedback. Apart from basic physical issues, there are other practical problems, such as the presence of significant gaps in the outgoing radiation data. Also, the radiation data involves two satellite systems, ERBE and CERES, with different properties. The 2011 paper by Lindzen and Choi describes how we deal with these issues. The fact that the data shows the absence of the long-wave feedback is extremely important. In all current GCMs, the contribution of the long-wave feedback alone doubles the sensitivity from the no-feedback value. In these models, the contributions of short-wave feedbacks can be as great as 0.3. However, the addition of this to 0.5 leads to an amplification by a factor of 5. The variation of the shortwave feedback factor between 0 and 0.3 in models is what basically leads to the IPCC claim that sensitivity is 2 to 5 degrees Celsius. However, if the longwave feedback factor is 0, or even negative, then the sensitivity with a shortwave feedback factor of 0.3 is no more than 1.4 degrees Celsius. And with a shortwave feedback of 0, the sensitivity can well be below 1 degree Celsius. The absence of a long wave feedback strongly suggests that something like the iris effect discovered in a 2001 paper by Linzing, Mingda Chow, and Arthur Hoy is causing the variations in upper level cirrus to cancel any positive water vapor feedback. Consistent with all this is the finding by Linson and Choi that no model correctly depicts the observed variations in outgoing radiation. As we have seen, the basis for the possibility of high sensitivity is either models or clearly incorrect approaches to data. In reality, the data all points to low sensitivity. It is sometimes asserted that paleoclimate data points to high sensitivity. This stems from a profound misunderstanding of the climate system. We will return to this last point later in this essay. Extreme weather and climate. The failure of the public to get unduly excited over a degree or two of warming has led the environmental alarmists to turn to the bogeyman of extreme weather. As even the IPCC acknowledges, there is no empirical evidence for such a connection. Moreover, outside the tropics, the claim runs opposite to what accepted theory implies. Outside of the tropics, the main process in generating weather disturbances is known as baroclinic instability, an instability whose energy is proportional to the horizontal gradient in temperature. Globally, the strength of this instability depends on the temperature difference between the tropics and high latitudes. In a warmer world, this difference is expected to decrease, not increase. Figure 7 is the temperature map for the 11th of March 2013 for North America. Air is carried roughly along the path of the jet stream, and this path changes from day to day and year to year. Record-breaking temperatures, regardless of the year that they occurred, correspond to the warmest and coldest temperatures on the map for the 11th of March 2013. In a warmer world, we expect the amplitude of the vacillations in the jet stream, as well as its magnitude, to decrease, suggesting a reduction in extreme events. In the tropics, it is frequently claimed that evaporation will increase in a warmer world, and that this will lead to extremes in precipitation, drought, storminess, etc. As already mentioned, there is no statistically significant empirical evidence for any of this. But it is interesting to ask whether even the underlying assertion is true. Will evaporation actually increase? In general, evaporation depends on both the temperature of the wet surface and the temperature and relative humidity of the air immediately above the surface. The assertion of increased evaporation depends on the assumption that the relative humidity of the surface air in a warmer world will remain unchanged from its earlier value. Not only is there no basis for this claim, but a change in relative humidity from 0.8 to 0.83 is sufficient to completely eliminate any increase in evaporation that would be caused by a warming of 3 degrees Celsius. And such changes in relative humidity at the surface are commonplace and easily produced. The sensitivity to such small changes is not an indication of the delicacy of the climate system, but rather an indication of the ease with which the system can adjust to changes. In the case of claims of increases in extreme weather, even models do not suggest this to any significant extent. The claims are made without basis for the simple purpose of frightening the public. However, when the public is told that every turn of the weather, whether unusual cold, warmth, snow, drought, etc., is proof of global warming, and when even the term global warming is changed to climate change, the public soon moves the issue into the realm of parody, with only the chattering classes continuing to pretend belief in the seriousness of the issue. The writers of insurance policies also find it profitable to take the claim seriously. Milankovitch versus naive climate picture. We have long known that the Earth has undergone ice ages when massive ice sheets covered much of North America and Scandinavia. However, only with the analysis of ice cores from Antarctica have we had a reasonably detailed history of ice volume, temperature, and CO2. Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth uses such a record to suggest that CO2 drives climate, since the record of CO2 tracks the temperature record. The CO2 record shows variations between 180 parts per million by volume and 280 parts per million by volume. The radiative forcing of the high value relative to the low value is about 2 watts per square meter to the negative 2, which is remarkably small. Moreover, there is substantial evidence that temperature changes preceded CO2 changes. During World War I, the Serbian astronomer Milutin Milanković argued that orbital changes associated with the obliquity cycles, the precession of the equinoxes, and variations in orbital eccentricity should have a profound effect on glaciation. His thinking was eminently reasonable. As is well known, the major factor in long-term glacial growth and retreat is summer insolation, the amount of incoming solar radiation. This determines whether snow that accumulates in winter will survive the summer. If it does, then snow will accumulate, forming glaciers. Milanković argued that the relevant quantity for forcing glacial cycles is the insolation in summer over the Arctic. The orbital variation of this quantity is about 100 watts per square meter to the -2, which is huge compared to the contribution due to CO2. Moreover, as the 2002 paper by Zverker Edvardsson et al. And the 2006 paper by Rowe have shown, the correlation of the Milanković parameter with the time rate of change of ice volume is about as good as any correlation in geophysics. Earlier claims of poor correlation resulted from using ice volume rather than its time rate of change. Also, the heat flux is consistent with what is needed to produce the phase changes involved in glaciations and deglaciations. On the other hand, the orbital changes result in almost no change whatever in the annually and globally averaged insolation. It is thus suggested that the minuscule radiative forcing due to CO2 is essential, and that the sensitivity is great. What relevance this has to the glaciation cycles is hard to see. The temperature changes associated with the glaciation cycles are sufficient to account for the changes in CO2, and the small imbalances are easily accommodated by slight changes in cloud cover, cloud brightness, and cloud height, all of which are known to vary substantially more than needed in the present climate. This suggests that the paradigm of climate represented by a single number, globally and annually averaged temperature anomaly, forced by a globally and annually averaged radiative imbalance, is totally inappropriate for the most important climate variability of the last million years. Conclusion. What we have seen is that the climate is probably insensitive to increases in greenhouse gases, and that there is little reason to suppose that a warmer world will be notably characterized by storminess and extremes, though both are part of normal weather variability. Scientific agreement is largely premised on agreement over trivial issues that are distinct from alarm. However, the acquiescence of science in this abuse is disturbing, to say the least. Climate Change: The Facts is published by Stockade Books. All rights reserved.